near the fire pit and took deep breaths to ward off the nausea. The wind picked up from the north, putting a cool bite in the air. Mrs. Starch's footsteps crunched on crisp twigs and leaves as she stalked back and forth in front of them. She seemed not quite as tall as Dick remembered. "You have no right to be here." "No right," she said. Marta raised a limp hand. "It was all Nick's idea."
"Undoubtedly," said Mrs. Starch.
"We just want to know what's going on," Nick heard himself say.
"Get more specific."
"Okay, the fire. Tell us about the fire."
"Ah," said Mrs. Starch.
"And smoke. I mean Duane Jr." The teacher stopped pacing and planted her knuckles on her hips.
"Anything else?"
"Yes," Nick said. He had so many questions. Marta peeped. "Your house. All those stuffed animals." Mrs. Starch wagged a bony forefinger in protest.
"No, that's personal. Way too personal."
Again, Nick heard an odd cry, like a bird trapped in a pillowcase.
"What is that?" he asked Mrs. Starch.
She glanced worriedly behind her. In the dappled shade, the anvil-shaped scar on her chin was so dark that it looked almost purple.
"I didn't hear anything," Marta said.
Mrs. Starch bent down until she was nose to nose with Nick, and up close her nose wasn't especially attractive. It was smudged with mud and freckled with what appeared to be tiny insect bites.
"I'm going to show you something extraordinary," she said. "But if either of you tells a living soul, if you blab a single word about this, then I swear I'll...
"Flunk us," said Nick.
"Kill us?" asked Marta.
"Worse," exclaimed Mrs. Starch. "I'll lose all respect for you. All respect."
Nick blinked. It was news to him that Mrs. Starch had any respect whatsoever for them, and judging by Marta's baffled reaction, it was news to her as well.
"Nobody else besides you two must know," the teacher said forcefully. "Not your mummy or daddy, not your gabby little pals on Facebook, not your third cousin in Goose Falls, Arkansas. Nobody. Is that clear?"
"As a bell," Marta murmured. Mrs. Starch grabbed Nick's left shoulder.
"This is life or death," she whispered. "Can you understand that?"
"We won't tell anyone," said Nick.
"Life or death," Mrs. Starch repeated. Then she dropped to all fours and scurried into her tent.
As expected, the local newspapers and TV stations identified Duane Scrott Jr. as an unnamed juvenile, with previous arrests for arson. But even if the authorities had released the boy's full name, the impact on Dr. Dressler's steady, well-organized existence would have been no more shattering. "Truman student, sought for arson, flees cops." That was just one of the unpleasant headlines that prompted the school's Board of Trustees to call an emergency meeting on a Saturday. The board members were highly distressed and asked many tough questions of Dr. Dressler, who answered as best he could. Some of the remarks were quite unfair, in the headmaster's opinion, yet he didn't waste energy trying to defend himself. The mood in the room was too tense, which he could understand. It was disgraceful enough that a Truman student had been charged with a serious crime, but the sensational media accounts of Duane Scrott Jr.'s escape and mad dash across campus, leaving the sheriff's detective panting in defeat, had pitched the Board of Trustees into a fever. Although technically it wasn't his job to arrest and handcuff arsonists, Dr. Dressler expected to be punished, possibly even fired, for allowing the detective to confront the boy while classes were in session.
In the end, the board voted to reprimand the headmaster and ordered him to expel Duane Scrod, Jr. from school effective immediately. When Dr. Dressler pointed out that Duane Jr.'s grandmother donated large sums of money to Truman every year, the board members quickly huddled for another vote. This time they decided that the boy should be suspended temporarily until his criminal case went to court, at which point his status at the Truman School would be reviewed. Dr. Dressler faced two undesirable chores. One was to notify Millicent Winship, Duane Jr.'s wealthy grandmother, and the other was to notify Duane Scrod Sr., his kooky father. The headmaster had flipped a coin, and now he was driving to the Scrod residence. Turning down the road, he noticed a sheriff's deputy sitting in a squad car parked on one corner. At the other end, he could see a black sedan with tinted windows, probably another officer in an unmarked car. They were waiting to grab Duane Scrod, Jr. if he tried to sneak home, although Dr. Dressler thought they'd have a better chance if they concealed themselves. The headmaster pulled in next to the graffiti-sprayed Tahoe belonging to Duane's father. As before, concert music was coming from the windows. Beethoven this time, not Bach. Reluctantly, Dr. Dressler got out of the car and trudged up the steps and rapped on the screen door. The stereo cut off and a raspy voice yelled, "Come in! Make it quick!" "Mr. Scrod?" Cautiously, the headmaster stepped inside. Duane Scrod Sr. was reclining in a Naugahyde lounger in front of the TV set. The picture was on, but the volume was turned down. Duane Sr.'s cap was propped crookedly on his head, and his faded shirt was unbuttoned to the waist. Perched on the threadbare arm of his chair was the enormous blue and gold macaw. "I remember you," Duane Scrod Sr. said groggily to Dr. Dressler. "So does Nadine.
May I sit down?"
"Nope. State your business and be on your way. I already had too many visitors today." Duane Sr. didn't take his eyes off the television screen. The bird, too, seemed entranced.
"What are you watching?" Dr. Dressler asked.
"A cooking show from France." That wouldn't have been the headmaster's first guess. Based on Duane Sr.'s rough appearance, Dr. Dressler would have expected to find him tuned to pro wrestling, or maybe a demolition derby on a Saturday morning. "But you can't judge a book by its cover," Dr. Dressler reminded himself. After all, the man was into classical music. Duane Sr. took a slug of Mountain Dew and said, "Junior's mom lives in Paris. We were thinking she might turn up on this TV show when they get to the part of the recipe where they put in the cheese. She has a shop, that's all she sells, fancy cheese. You imagine?" Dr. Dressler didn't know what to say. He reached in his coat and took out two packets of onion crackers from the school cafeteria. "I brought these for Nadine." In a flash, the bird swooped across the room and snatched the treat from his hand, then flew back to the chair. Duane Scrod Sr. scolded the macaw for bad manners. "What do you say to the man, Nadine?"
"Thank a million,"
the bird squeaked.
"Dr. Shan, merci beaucoup."
Dr. Dressler pressed onward.
"I came to talk to you about Duane Jr.," he said. "After everything that's happened, I'm afraid we have to suspend him from school."
Duane Scrod Sr. finally turned and stared directly at the headmaster. "I sure don't want to be the one to tell his granny."
"No, sir, that's my job. Did you see the news?"
"Yeah. At least they left his name out of it."
"The situation is very serious," Dr. Dressler said. Duane Sr. agreed.
"It's a shame, too. Past few days, DJ's been hitting the books pretty hard, and all this nonsense had to break loose." He brushed a piece of cracker off his sleeve and said,
Nadine, you eat like a pig. He and the bird returned their attention to the French cooking program. Dr. Dressler stood there, feeling out of place and unsure what to do next. As headmaster of the Truman School, he had a duty in such troubled moments to say something wise and helpful to parents. But never before had he dealt with a character like Duane Scrod, Sr. "Can I say one more thing?" Dr. Dressler asked.
"All right, but only 'cause you brought crackers."
"The best thing your son can do is turn himself in to the police as soon as possible." Duane Sr. scratched his cap.
"You might be right, but what if you're not? What happens to Junior then?"
"Mr. Scrod, they'll catch up with him eventually," Dr. Dressler said. "And when they do, they'll come down twice as hard. You see, Duane, please tell him."
"Heck, tell him yourself. Hey, Junior!"
Duane Scrod Sr. sat forward and raised his voice.
"DJ, come on out of here."
Dr. Dressler heard a door creak, followed by footsteps in the hallway. Duane Scrod Jr. appeared looking calm but serious. He wore camouflage hunting-style clothes and carried his motorcycle helmet under one arm. The headmaster had never been in the presence of a fugitive, was more nervous than Duane Jr.
"What are you doing here?" he asked the boy.
"My laundry," Duane Jr. replied matter-of-factly.
"But the police are staked out at both ends of the street."
"I came in the back way," the boy explained. "Through the neighbor's yard. They're at the rodeo in Zolfo Springs."
Duane Sr. spoke up. "Junior, the man says you're suspended from school."
"Duh."
"He also says you should give yourself up."
"Yeah, right," said Duane Jr.
The bird squeaked, rose from the chair, and buzzed Dr. Dressler in search of more crackers. The headmaster ducked to no avail. The macaw landed squarely on his neck and began poking its gnarly beak through his hair.
"Nadine!" barked Duane Scrod Sr.
"Help me,"
Dr. Dressler whimpered. Duane Jr. grabbed the bird and launched it out the front door. His father sighed and sat back to watch the cooking program. Dr. Dressler gingerly probed the collar of his shirt to make sure that Nadine hadn't left him a nasty little present.
"That bird's a royal pain," Duane Jr. muttered, wiping his hands on his trousers.
"Am I bleeding?" Dr. Dressler asked.
"Just a scratch. Wash it out real good when you get home."
The headmaster weighed his next words carefully.
"Duane, you can't keep running forever."
"I don't plan to."
"If you had a lawyer, he'd advise you to surrender to the police immediately."
"And I'd tell him the same thing I'm telling you," Duane Jr. said.
"I can't prove I'm innocent if I'm locked up in jail."
"Duane, just listen."
"No, you listen. I didn't set that fire, and I'm not taking the fall."
Duane Jr. looked angry, and it didn't seem like an act. Over the years, the headmaster had heard many lame lies and invented stories from students who'd gotten into trouble, and he regarded himself as a hard man to fool. Now, as he looked into Duane Scrod Jr.'s eyes, it occurred to Dr. Dressler that the boy might be telling the truth.
"If you aren't the arsonist, who is?"
"No idea," Duane Jr. said.
"How'd your book bag end up in the swamp?"
Duane Jr. glanced over at his father and lowered his voice. "Pop says a tax man came here and stole it, but who knows? Some days he's all over the map." They heard a loud thwap and turned to see Nadine hanging like a giant moth on the screen door. Duane Sr. looked up from the TV and shook a fist.
"Don't you dare let her back in till she says she's sorry. In all three languages, too."
Duane Jr. paid no attention. To Dr. Dressler, he said, "Now I got a question for you."
"Certainly."
The headmaster was eager to offer some sensible guidance, but that was not what the young man wanted.
"Be straight up with me," he said.
After you leave this house, are you going to run and tell those cops I'm here?
Dr. Dressler hesitated, yet only for a moment. He was startled to hear himself say,
No, Duane, I won't be the word. That's a promise.
Thanks, dude. The other boy called smoke and disappeared down the hall.
Mrs. Starch came out of the tent, cradling her straw hat with the crown face down. The hat seemed to be crying.
Hush now, said Mrs. Starch.
Then very quietly to Marta, there's a cooler full of milk bottles under the tarp. Would you please get me one?
Mrs. Starch sat cross-legged at the base of a cypress tree with a hat in her lap. She warmed the bottle in her hands, uncapped it, and attached a rubber nipple. Nick and Marta knelt in front of her. Peeking inside the hat, they saw a squirming ball of honey-colored fur. It was a kitten unlike any they'd ever seen.
We call him Squirt, Mrs. Stark said, because he pees all day long.
The little cat lunged for the bottle and began to suck noisily. When Marta reached to pet it, Mrs. Stark stopped her.
Rule number one, no cuddling, she said.
He's so awesome, Marta whispered, edging as close as Mrs. Starch would allow. What is it?
I bet Nick knows.
He said, it's a baby panther. A smaller, living and breathing version of the stuffed one that he'd seen in Mrs. Starch's house. The teacher smiled.
That's correct. A Florida panther. Scientific name?
Puma concolor. Corii.
Correct again. Somebody's actually read the class syllabus, Mrs. Starch said. The other acceptable answer would be Felis concolor corii, although Puma is more poetic. In parts of South America, the word means mighty magic animal.
To Nick, the kitten was a thing of unreal beauty, exotic yet delicate. Its pelt was dappled with spots that would fade over time, and its long, tawny tail bent upward at the end, but was ringed almost like a leopard's. Oversized and pointy, the ears were woolly and as white as cotton on the inside. The panther's muzzle was framed by bands of coal-black fur, now dribbled with milk, that gave the appearance of an outlaw-style mustache. Its eyes, barely open, were a creamy shade of blue. Soon they would turn brown and eventually pale gold, Nick remembered from his reading. The front paws, already larger than a tomcat's, were clasped around the rim of the nursing bottle. And what a powerful motor for such a pint-sized critter. More rumble than purr.
Where's the mama? Marta wanted to know. Not so loud, dear, Mrs. Stott said.
Is the mother cat dead? Nick asked, fearing the worst. There were so few panthers left in the wild that hardly anybody ever laid eyes on one.
No, the mother's alive, Mrs. Stott said. At least that's what Mr. Spree believes, and he fancies himself the expert.
The kitten abruptly spit out the nipple and emitted a lion-sized burp. Mrs. Starch laughed, an uncommon sight. To Nick and Marta, she said,
You two have lots of questions, and I'll get to all of them in due time. But right now, little Sir Squirt needs to finish his lunch. Don't you, baby?
As if on cue, the cat mewed for more formula. Mrs. Starch gently lifted the bottle to the kitten's mouth and began humming a lullaby. The tune was surprisingly soothing and pretty. Marta and Nick were stunned. This was a side of their teacher that they'd never observed, or had even imagined to be part of her buzzsaw personality. So for a while they sat peacefully in the swamp, listening to Mrs. Starch hum, while the little panther slurped happily, and the emerald leaves overhead shimmied and shook in the sunlight. The cool breeze felt good. Nick reached for Marta's hand.
20. On his search for the missing panther, Twitty Spree had crisscrossed hundreds of acres in the black vine swamp. The quest was slow and often tedious, and on this day it led him toward an impressive cypress stand that he had not yet explored. Neck bent, eyes bolted to the ground, he moved ahead with measured, deliberate steps. In thick cover, panther poop wasn't always easy to see. A flash of pink caught his attention, and at first it looked like the petal of a morning glory. Yet when Twilly picked it up, he found himself holding a small flag attached to a wire stem. Then he spotted another flag, and then another, and still more, planted in a perfectly straight line. Twilly's stride quickened. He followed the markers to the edge of the cypress, where he came upon a mucky area that appeared to have been flattened by all-terrain vehicles turning around, backing up, braking, spinning their fat wheels. He moved along, uprooting each plastic flag he saw. The trail took him under the lush canopy and into a wide clearing, so sheltered by trees that it was virtually capped off from the sun and the sky. The centerpiece was a man-made rectangular pit. Nearby loomed a stack of black iron pipes twice as tall as Twilly Spree, and of the same 8-inch diameter as those he'd confiscated on the oil company's property and donated to Haiti. There were also 4 pallets of 2x4s, a circular water tank empty, and a fuel tank full. On the opposite side of the clearing sat several crates bearing shipping labels from equipment companies in Texas and Oklahoma. The labels were all addressed to J.L. Bayless, DBA Red Diamond. Twilly pried the lid off one bulky container, revealing a new diesel engine that he assumed would be used to power the drill. He walked to the rim of the mud pit, which had partially filled with groundwater. To clear and dig out such a site in secrecy would have required careful timing and a small work crew. The project was ambitious, expensive, and highly illegal. From the research gathered by his private investigators, Twilly knew that Red Diamond didn't own or lease this particular section of land. It was part of a wildlife preserve that belonged to the state of Florida. In the cool dome of shade, Twilly Spree sat down on a crate to ponder what he should do next. He stroked the brittle old buzzard beaks that dangled from his neck in case they might hold a trace of native magic, or any magic at all. As soon as the Cat in the Hat fell asleep, Mrs. Starch took it back to the tent. When she emerged, she said, "Now, where's that delicious cold pizza?" Nick brought her the boxes. Mrs. Starch wolfed down 4 slices without pausing. Marta said, "How old is the kitten?"
"Only a few weeks, according to Mr. Spree. But my manners were short of napkins."
Mrs. Starch wiped her sleeve across her lips.
"Squirt needs mama's milk. For now, we're feeding him a special formula prepared by a friend of Mr. Spree who works at the Metro Zoo. The bottles are delivered every Tuesday and Friday by private helicopter, which gives you an idea of Mr. Spree's resources."
"You mean he's, like, rich?" Marta said.
"He so doesn't look it," Mrs. Starch said. "The cub is too young. Without his mother, he's not going to make it. Even if I spend the next year of my life out here in the boonies taking care of him, I can't teach him how to hunt."
"What about giving him to the zoo?" Marta asked.
"Mr. Spree says no. He says the subject is closed."
Nick asked Mrs. Starch to start at the beginning. "On the field trip," he said, "when the fire broke out."
"Yes, indeed. And you went back into the woods for Libby's medicine."
Marta said, "Yeah, that was very,
Mrs. Starch arched an eyebrow. "Very what?"
"Brave." Marta flinched with guilt. Nick knew she felt bad because of all the mean things she'd said about Mrs. Starch. The teacher said, "Sorry to disappoint you, but I'm not a witch." Marta's face reddened. "How did you know I called you that?"
"I wear a hearing aid in class. I don't really need one, but I do enjoy eavesdropping when you kids start to whisper." Mrs. Stark smiled slyly. No bigger than a button. You probably never noticed. Marta looked mortified.
Oh, you aren't the first student to call me a witch, Mrs. Stark said, or to use a cruder word that rhymes.
All Marta could say was, I didn't mean it.
Yes, you did. But that's all right. Mrs. Stark didn't sound angry or resentful. Look, my job is to fill young minds with knowledge, and certain fields of knowledge can be boring at times. Really boring. Which means I have to be tough in order to keep my students focused. I don't expect to win any popularity contests, but at least you'll be able to write 500 intelligent words about the Kelvin cycle when you finish my course. She opened a different cooler and took out 3 bottles of cold water, keeping one for herself and handing the others to Nick and Marta. Getting back to the fire, she said. Took me a while to locate the spot where Libby dropped her asthma inhaler. The smoke was heavy and I started to cough. My lungs burned, my eyes stung, and before long I lost my way back to the boardwalk. Simply could not find it. In fact, I could hardly see the nose in front of my face. And it's not a nose that's easy to miss, as you've undoubtedly noticed.
What did you do? Nick asked.
Freaked out, of course, Mrs. Stark said.
Marta stifled a giggle.
I babbled, blubbered, yelled for help, the teacher went on. I honestly thought I might burn to death in the middle of this swamp. Then, out of nowhere, somebody runs up from behind.
Twilly, Marta guessed.
Correct. He grabs my hand and practically drags me all the way to this camp. Doesn't ask who I am or even if I'm hurt. All he says is, I need your help. Nick was trying to visualize the scene. Twilly could make a strong first impression.
Weren't you scared of him?
I was more scared of the fire, Mrs. Stark said. Mr. Spree washed out my eyes with distilled water, gave me a warm beer to drink, which I declined. Then he showed me that exquisite, glorious little feline. Her voice trailed off as she looked sadly toward the tent.
Did you know what it was? Marta asked.
Of course. I know every endangered species in Florida, and you should, too.
Right. I'm working on it, said Marta.
Mr. Spree told me that the mother panther had been scared off by some jerk with a gun. He'd found the kitten crying in the woods. It was so tiny its eyes wouldn't even open. Next thing I know, he places it in my arms and gives me a baby bottle and says, if you don't feed it, it's going to die. And it might die anyway if we can't find its mama soon. So here I am.
A substitute, Nick said. This was the family emergency that was keeping Mrs. Stark out of school.
Nursemaid, surrogate, cat sitter. I had no choice but to step up, she said. Mr. Spree couldn't take care of Squirt if he was gone all day trying to track down the mother. So I arranged to take my first and only leave of absence from the Truman School in 18 years. My one regret is that you students were subjected to Dr. Waxmo, who frankly belongs in a different profession.
The circus, perhaps.
Marta let out a groan.
That man's a total nightmare.
Oh, I know, Mrs. Stark said ruefully. Duane gave me a full report on Wendell. I sent Mr. Spree to chat with him, and he took ill shortly thereafter. Anyway, the new substitute, Mrs. Robertson, is a very able teacher.
Wait a minute. How does Duane fit into this whole picture? Nick asked.
I'm getting to that part. Be patient. The police are after him. They think he set the fire to get back at you for what happened in school, but he told me he didn't do it. Somebody stole his book bag and planted it out here to get him in trouble.
Mrs. Stark took a long, leisurely drink from the water bottle. She said,
according to the newspaper, a butane torch was also found. That looks mighty suspicious.
Nick heard his voice rise.
But I know Duane's telling the truth about his backpack getting ripped off because he came over to borrow my biology book.
Yeah, to study for an imaginary test, Marta cut in skeptically.
Mrs. Stark raised a hand. It wasn't imaginary.
I wrote up a test especially for Duane. I've been privately tutoring him in several subjects, academic and otherwise. You might have noticed a change in his punctuality and neatness at school. Even his acne has improved, thanks to good old-fashioned soap and water. Nick thought, that explains Smoke's mysterious transformation. It was Mrs. Starch who created the new Duane Scrod, Jr. And by the way, she added, you're right, the young man is completely innocent of that arson. Now please don't interrupt me again. Her tone was one that Nick and Marta remembered all too well from class. They fell silent and listened. Might seem strange that Duane and I are part of the same team, said Mrs. Starch, but we've got more in common than you think. Nick couldn't imagine what that could be. Well, one thing, we both love the wilderness, she went on. Duane is happiest when he's out fishing or camping or scouting for bears and deer. My own interest is endangered wildlife, as you surely figured out after sneaking into my house. Each of those mounted birds and reptiles and mammals that you saw was killed on the highway or in a storm or shot. The young panther, too? Nick asked. Sadly, yes. Struck by a car on the Tamiami Trail. I saw the body one afternoon while driving home from Miami, and I brought it to a taxidermist here in town, an old friend. With the usual bluntness, Marta said, there's more dead animals in your house than I ever saw before, except in a museum. Mrs. Starch explained that she'd had the mounts made because she believed she would never get a glimpse of those species free in the wild. Tragically, there are too few left. She went to check on the panther cub and returned with a bag of trail mix. Nick and Marta weren't hungry. They were too caught up in her story. Munching away, Mrs. Starch continued. Here's something else that Duane and I share. We both know what it's like to be abandoned, dumped in the current jargon. One day, Duane's mother just lit out for France without even telling him. My husband did the same thing. Not to Paris, but to Plano, Texas, which is more his speed. I don't know why he walked out on me, but it hurt. Still does. Marta squirmed, which meant she thought of something else to ask. Nick knew what was coming. There's a rumor that something bad happened to Mr. Starch, Marta said. That he's, like, dead and stuffed like a moose. It would be better than he deserves, Mrs. Starch remarked dryly. No, Stanley Starch is very much alive and kicking. Every April I get a birthday card telling me about his latest girlfriend. Is there any other ugly gossip I should know about? Snakes. They say you keep poisonous snakes in your basement. Rattlers and moccasins, copperheads. Marta was on a roll, and Nick couldn't do anything about it. Also untrue, Mrs. Starch said. For a while I was lucky enough to have a pair of eastern indigo snakes, which were rescued from a construction site by one of my students. The indigo is absolutely gorgeous, totally harmless and nearly extinct. I released mine far out in the Fakahatchee, where I hope they found true snake love and made lots of babies. Anything else? No, said Nick quickly. Yes, said Marta. That! She touched a finger to her chin. Ah, the scar. Far from annoyed, Mrs. Starch seemed amused by Marta's boldness. Apologetically, Nick said, it's none of our business. That's right, but I'll tell you anyway, Mrs. Starch said. It happened when I was about your age. An osprey chick fell out of its nest, and being young and fearless, I decided to climb all the way up and put the little fella back with his brother and sister. The nest was high on a utility pole and the wind was howling, but somehow I made it to the top. Marta asked, so what happened? Did the birds bite your face or something? Heavens, no. They were timid as they could be. Halfway down the pole, one of my sandals slipped off the pegs, and I dropped about 20 feet, I believe the term is face plant, onto a glass soda bottle that a litter bug had tossed by the side of the road. Mrs. Starch tapped her scar. Some people say it's the shape of an anvil, some say an hourglass. But no, Marta, it's not the mark of the devil. It's the mark of the Pepsi-Cola company.
How many stitches?
Foolishly, I refused to go to the hospital. Thus the unsightly result. Mrs. Starch stretched her arms. She said she was tired and needed a nap. Wait here for Mr. Spree. He'll drive you back to town. And remember, you're both sworn to secrecy. You haven't gone home since the fire? Nick asked.
No, I've stayed right here, day and night. Mr. Spree has been good enough to run all my errands, beginning with the return of Libby's asthma medicine. He even got the tires rotated on my car.
Marta sat upright.
Listen.
It was the faraway whine of a high-pitched engine, gear shifting. Mrs. Starch looked anything but worried.
A friendly, she said. One of us.
Is it Duane? Nick asked.
Correct.
Here's what I don't understand. How did you get him to help? That day he bit your pencil in half, he was seriously ticked off about the pimple paper, Nick said.
Oh, I never asked Duane to get involved in this project. Wouldn't have dreamed of it, Mrs. Starch asserted.
Believe me, that boy was numero uno on my list of troublemakers. It was Mr. Spree who recruited him. They knew each other from a past adventure.
Marta said, that figures.
Yes, it's a small world. Imagine my shock when Duane strolled into camp one morning.
Imagine his shock, thought Nick.
The motorcycle, much closer and noisier than before, suddenly spluttered to a stop.
He'll hide the bike in the woods and hike in from the south, Mrs. Starch explained. Usually it takes him another half hour or so.
Nick's head was pounding as he struggled to absorb everything the teacher had told him.
But how did Twilly meet Duane?
He asked.
What kind of adventure are you talking about?
That I cannot answer. Speak to Mr. Spree.
Mrs. Starch yawned and said, Marta, may I have a word with Nick privately in my tent?
Marta looked around dubiously.
What am I supposed to do out here all by myself?
Listen to the birds. Nick got down and followed Mrs. Starch into the tent. Crawling wasn't easy with his right arm bound. He hopped like a three-legged dog. He managed to fit himself cross-legged on the ground beside her sleeping bag. Arranged neatly on a square of cardboard were a few basic items. Flashlight, toothbrush, mouthwash, hairbrush, a bottle of aspirin, bar of soap, and some note-sized lavender envelopes. There was also a small manual typewriter. Nick felt uneasy in her personal space. Here, she handed him the straw hat, which he held in the crook of his left arm. The kitten was dozing in the shape of a fuzzy, plump comma. Its padded paws covered its face, muffling a muscular snore. Mrs. Starch dropped her voice.
Nick, do you want to be part of this? And help your friend Duane at the same time?
Nick couldn't take his eyes off the cat. It was astonishing to think that he was holding one of the last panthers on Earth.
Are you in or out? Mrs. Starch asked.
In.
You must be certain.
I am.
Excellent.
She took the hat with the kitten and positioned it carefully on the soft flannel flap of her sleeping bag.
Nick, I'm going to ask you to do something.
Sure.
Take off that sling.
He was caught by surprise.
How come?
Mrs. Dart said, I know why you're wearing it. Duane told us what happened to your father, and I admire your devotion. But here's the present situation in the Black Vine Swamp. For what lies ahead, each of us will require a strong heart and two good arms. We need 100% of you. Nick hesitated.
Your dad would understand, she said.
He removed his shirt and she helped unwrap the ace bandage from his shoulder and armpit. Once his right arm was unbound, he flexed his elbow and made a fist with his hand to get the circulation flowing.
What if Twilly can't find the mother panther? He asked Mrs. Starch. Or what if she won't take back her cub?
Hope springs eternal, Nick.
Again they heard an engine in the distance. Mrs. Starch frowned, tilting an ear toward the sound.
That's not a motorcycle, she said. It's a helicopter.
Friendly?
I seriously doubt it.
21.
Jimmy Lee Bayless held the gun across his lap, which made the chopper pilot nervous.
"Relax, I know what I'm doing," Jimmy Lee Bayless said, which wasn't altogether true.
He'd never been a very good shot. Any target, moving or non-moving, presented a challenge. His buddies back in Texas invited him along on hunting trips, mostly out of pity. The deer rifle in his hands had never killed a deer or even come close, though it had frightened many. That's all Jimmy Lee Bayless aimed to do if he came across the trespassers, who were hassling Melton and messing with Red Diamond's gear. Scare him off by firing a couple of rounds over their sneaky heads. Same as he'd done to that panther. The pilot said,
"You got the safety on, right?"
"Give me a break." Jimmy Lee Bayless peeked at the safety button above the trigger. He was relieved to see that it was, in fact, on.
"Got any Tums?" he asked the pilot. "No, I don't."
"Roll aids?"
"Sorry."
"Maalocs?"
"Do you want me to set it down so you can make a potty stop?"
"No."
Jimmy Lee Bayless wondered if his boss was feeling better. The nurses had been taping Drake McBride's ribs when Jimmy Lee Bayless had left him at the hospital, cussing and whining and making a nuisance of himself. The pilot said,
"How low do you want to go?"
200 feet, give or take.
They circled Section 21 for 15 minutes and saw no life on the ground except for a pair of wild boars. Jimmy Lee Bayless decided to shoot at them for target practice. However, the pilot took his sweet time setting the helicopter in a hover, and the pigs trotted safely into the scrub.
"Nice work," Jimmy Lee Bayless grumbled.
"Where to now?"
"The usual."
Section 22 appeared quiet, too. Jimmy Lee Bayless ordered the pilot to take an extra slow pass to make sure the Red Diamond's pirate well was still invisible from the air. A person looking hard enough might have noticed ATV tracks at the offloading site, but the natural suspects would be deer poachers, not oil drillers. As the chopper climbed to 500 feet and angled slowly back toward the coast, the pilot pointed out his window and said,
"Hey, check it out!"
At first, Jimmy Lee Bayless couldn't see what he was talking about. Then, as the nose of the aircraft tipped, the scene came into full view. His mouth went dry and his ears got hot.
"Hold it here," he barked at the pilot. "Now! 10-4, why are you laughing?" "'Cause it's funny," the pilot said. "Not to me, it ain't. Not to Mr. McBride, either. The man is paying for this woolly bird." "Okay, fine. It's not funny." "Damn right it's not."
Jimmy Lee Bayless was steaming mad. All the pink flags, once laid out so precisely with the eye of a surveyor, marking the future path of the illegal pipeline from Section 22 to Section 21, had been yanked from their holes, uprooted by an unknown hand. A criminal's hand it was, too. Some warped outlaw, some lame excuse for a comedian who had replanted them on their stems, all those little pink flags, brightening a patch of parched prairie like candles on cornbread, rearranged in such an obvious way that anyone flying low enough in a helicopter couldn't help but see the double-edged insult. S-C-A-T, the flag sneered in fluttering capital letters, as cheery as confetti. Scat!
"Either he's telling you to go away," the pilot mused, "or he's calling your name."
"Or both," thought Jimmy Lee Bayless with disgust. Still shading a grin, the pilot said,
"You want me to land so you can look around?"
"No, sir," Jimmy Lee Bayless said gravely. "I want you to find out where I can rent me some bloodhounds."
They heard Smoke's motorcycle crank up and speed off. Mrs. Starch said the helicopter must have spooked him. Nick peered up through the thick branches at a blue pane of sky. Was it the sheriff?
I don't believe so.
Marta was dejectedly examining her waterlogged sneakers.
"We need to go," she said. "Is it safe yet?"
"Not without Mr. Spree." Mrs. Starch opened the second pizza box. "Anybody care for a slice?"
Nick said, "So what exactly is the master plan?"
Marta jerked on his right sleeve. "If I don't get home soon, I'm going to be grounded until I'm like 100.
"Hey, your arm grew back."
"Teacher's orders," said Mrs. Starch, gnawing on a slice of pepperoni. "Is it Saturday or Sunday? I lose track of time out here."
Nick told her it was Saturday, her brow furrowed, but she continued to eat. Marta reached over and flicked a fat red ant off her pants.
"The plan," said Mrs. Starch, "is to get that kitten back with his mama as soon as possible. The longer they're apart, the harder it's going to be. There will come a day, sadly, when the mother cat simply gives up and moves on."
"Okay, what can we do?" Nick asked.
"Number one, stay close to Duane. Make sure he doesn't try anything crazy."
Marta rolled her eyes. "You mean like running from the cops? Gee, that's not crazy at all."
Nick said, "Mrs. Starch, nobody gets close to smoke."
"And what does that have to do with the Panthers anyway?" Marta asked.
Patiently, Mrs. Starch explained, "Your friend Duane has a special talent that's crucial to this mission. There's no chance of succeeding without him."
Nick was intrigued. "What kind of talent?"
Exasperated, Marta said,
"He's a fugitive. If we help him, we're breaking the law."
"But he's also innocent," Nick thought. Another heavy decision. "Watch after Duane, please," Mrs. Starch urged. "If you don't, Squirt might die out here in my arms, so watch after Duane." A sharp, familiar whistle rose from 50 yards away. Mrs. Starch smiled and glanced at the watch on her wrist. Twilly Spree entered the campsite at a dead run. He was panting hard and slick with sweat.
"Let's move," he snapped, beckoning to Marta and Nick.
"Finally," Marta said and sprang to her feet. Nick asked Twilly what was wrong.
"Just follow me and stay quiet," he said.
Mrs. Starch stood up.
"Hold on, what happened?" "I'll tell you later."
The teacher folded her arms rigidly as if addressing a wayward pupil.
"What did you do now, Mr. Spree?"
"I left them a message. They deserved it."
"What sort of message?"
"The four-letter sort."
"Oh, Lord," said Mrs. Starch.
"Don't bother sharing it, please. I couldn't resist."
"Take these young people back to town immediately and try not to corrupt them on the way." The jog to the car was tense and hurried, Twilly keeping well ahead of Nick and Marta as he bowled through the hammocks and bounded across the flatlands and vaulted over the saw palmettos. Nick was glad to have both arms free to shield his face from the whippy twigs, ropey vines, and gluey spiderwebs. Marta struggled to stay close, and as instructed by Twilly, said nothing. It was an ordeal for her to remain quiet for more than a few minutes, and Nick was impressed by her self-restraint. The Prius was barreling down the rutted farm road, Nick and Marta bouncing against their seat belts, when Twilly finally spoke.
"How much did Aunt Bunny tell you?" he asked.
"Everything except the part about how smoke got involved," Nick said.
"I see.
It would be good to know."
"Good for whom?" said Twilly. He put on his ski beanie and black wraparound sunglasses.
Marta sat forward. "You trust us. Stop pretending that you don't."
"Ha!"
But a few minutes later, Twilly grudgingly opened up. "A couple of years ago, I was driving from Tallahassee to Chokoloskee nonstop. Don't ask why. After about 17 cups of coffee, I pull off the interstate to answer the call of nature."
"Where?" Nick asked.
"Right here in Naples. Beautiful exit 101. Twilly said. 4 in the morning, fog thicker than clam chowder, and I'm standing there watering the weeds under some billboard when I smell smoke. And I don't mean your friend. I mean smoke as in fire. I look up through the mist and see flames. The billboard is definitely burning."
"It was Duane being a pyro, right?" Marta said.
"I took off from one way and he took off from another,
and we literally ran smack into each other, Twilly recalled. First thing out of his mouth, I'm the one who did it. As if I hadn't figured that out, him with his jerry can of gasoline and burned mops. I asked him why, and he told me. I asked his name, and he told me that, too. Then we heard the sirens, and I promptly hauled butt. Duane, he stayed behind and gave himself up. Wanda asked why Smoke hadn't escaped while he had the chance. Twilly said he didn't know. But I tell you what was on that billboard he torched. A big ad for American Airlines. They were running a winter special. Miami to Paris for $395. Paris, Nick said. Now it made sense. Mrs. Starch told us about Duane's mom. Yeah, a tough deal. Twilly shook his head ruefully. Was that the same flight she took? Marta asked. Never even said goodbye. That sucks, Dick said. Big time. I felt bad for the kid, said Twilly. Offered to find him a good defense lawyer, but his granny took care of all that. He ended up getting probation for torching the billboard. But you stayed in touch, Marta said. We go fishing now and then. Nick couldn't wait any longer to ask. Why do you need Smoke's help to save the baby panther? What's his special talent that Mrs. Starch was talking about? Simple. The boy's a born tracker. Anybody can find the mother cat. It's him. Twilly told him about a camping trip to Highlands County when Duane Scrod Jr. dogged the trail of a black bear for miles at night in a driving rain across two muddy creeks and three county roads all the way to the animal's den tree. Then he carved his initials in the trunk, turned around, and hiked back to the storm as giddy as a child on Christmas morning. It's a gift. Even the old Seminoles aren't sure how he does it, Twilly said. So the plan is for me to find the scat, and then put Duane on the trail of the panther. Once we know where she is, we turn the cub loose nearby. After that, there's nothing left to do but pray they find each other before a bobcat or a coyote gobbles the little one. Marta shuddered at the thought. Have you seen any, you know? Panther poop? Yes, ma'am. I hit the jackpot yesterday. Whether it was left by Squirt's mother or not, I couldn't say. The car struck a pothole and Twilly grunted. There's an oil company out here that's up to no good, he said. They don't want anybody snooping around, especially game wardens, on the lookout for endangered critters. For Nick, the threads of the story were coming together at last. That's who started the fire at the Black Vine Swamp, isn't it? The oil guys. That's who framed Smoke. Yeah. And that's who scared off the Mama Panther, Twilly added, with a gun. The Red Diamond Energy Corporation. Marta was outraged. How do we stop them? What can we do? They've had a few problems finishing their project. They're about to have more. Nick said, are you a monkey wrencher? In the rearview mirror, he could see Twilly react with a curious smile. Well, are you? Nick asked. In that book I'm reading, this crazy gang is running around the desert, blowing up bridges, wrecking bulldozers. Burning billboards, Twilly added with a wink. Acts of crime, each and every one. Well, it's hard not to root for those folks, isn't it? Fighting to save a place they love. To Nick, Marta whispered, I guess that answers your question. Twilly said, there's some rough language in that book. Maybe you should put it down until you're older. Tell the truth. Are you trying to be Hey Duke? Nick was referring to the fictional leader of the Monkey Wrench Gang. When Twilly spoke again, he sounded tired and impatient. Do you remember that panther screaming on the day of the fire? I'll never forget it, Nick said. Marta shuddered. Me neither. Well, that was the cat I'd been hunting for. I'd come across her tracks near the road where your school bus was parked, so I knew she was close, hunkered down, and waiting for dusk, probably waiting to come search for her baby.
Tully drummed his fingers on the steering wheel. Then the fire started, or I should say the arson. She took off again, Nick said. Tully nodded grimly. Most wild animals, they run at the first whiff of smoke, he said. But there's a chance she's back. The scat I found yesterday was fresh. They reached the intersection at Route 29, where Tully turned south and ended up behind a line of vegetable trucks. How long until she forgets about the cub? Nick asked. Each day the odds get worse. A sheriff's car sped by, going the opposite direction. Nick noticed that Tully was driving 5 miles below the speed limit and was dutifully wearing his seatbelt. What the heck were you doing out in that swamp when you found the kitten? Marta asked. Minding my own business, Tully replied. You should try it sometime. Mrs. Starch says you're rich. Just born lucky. Nick said, definitely not, hey, Duke. Tully steered the car off the pavement and parked near a row of newspaper racks. He snatched the ski beanie from his head, rubbed his brow, and then suddenly slugged the dashboard so hard that Nick and Marta jumped. Turning in his seat, Tully raised his sunglasses and fixed the kids with a raw, pained stare. Let me tell you something even dear Aunt Bunny doesn't know, he said. After that, don't ever ask again about who I am or am not, or why a man like me lives in a tent. I've got a gut full of anger about what's happening to this land and everything that lives out here. That's all you need to know. He sounded more sorrowful than angry. Some days are worse than others, he said. Nick and Marta weren't sure how to react. Tully raised 2 fingers. That's how many there were. How many what? Marta asked, puzzled. Panther cubs, he said. That's how many I found. The mother cat had 2. Nick closed his eyes. One of them died, Tully said. I tried everything, but the smaller one didn't make it through the first night. I never told Bunny or Duane, never told anybody. Marta covered her face. Tully lowered his glasses. Any more questions? No, said Nick quietly. No more. 22. On Sunday morning, Duane Scrod Sr. dragged himself out of bed and stumbled to the front door. How'd you get here so fast? He asked Millicent Winship.
Chartered a jet plane. Now open the door.
With fake cheer, Duane Scrod Sr. welcomed his mother-in-law into the house. She almost knocked him down as she whisked past. There was not a wrinkle to be seen in her elegant gray pantsuit, nor one silver hair out of place on her head.
Did you sleep in that stupid hat? She asked. I guess.
Duane Sr. was more worried about her reaction to his NASCAR boxer shorts. Mrs. Winship scowled and looked away.
Go put on some pants, for heaven's sake! And keep that awful parrot away from me, or I'll pluck her bald.
Millie, she's not a parrot. She's a macaw.
A nuisance is what she is. Hurry up!
Duane Scrod Sr. pulled on some blue jeans and wrestled Nadine into her cage. When he returned to the living room, Mrs. Winship was waiting with folded arms.
So, my grandson is now a fugitive, she said. I got the whole ugly story from the headmaster. DJ's been suspended from Truman as well. But I suppose that's the least of our problems.
The cops are making a big mistake.
Where is he now?
I don't honestly know, Duane Sr. said. He comes and goes like some sort of ghost.
And you have no way of reaching him. What about the cell phone I bought him?
He never picks up, Millie. Did you tell his mom about this mess?
Of course. I phoned her right away.
Is she coming back?
No, Duane. What good would that do?
Mrs. Winship brushed the stale cracker crumbs off a chair and sat down. Her daughter had offered to call the boy and urge him to surrender, but she had not offered to come home and see him.
Duane Sr. said, "It's not cheap, I guess, flying all the way from France."
"Money has nothing to do with it. I would have bought her a first-class ticket."
"Then what?" The only time that Mrs. Winship felt old was when she had to talk about her daughter. "Whitney says she has to stay and take care of the shop. She says it's the busy season." Duane Sr. gazed drearily at the floor. "In other words, cheese is more important than her own flesh and blood." "I'm sorry, Duane. Truly I am." "What's going to happen to Junior?"
"I've contacted a lawyer. Where do you think he's hiding?"
"Somewhere out there in the boonies." Duane Sr. motioned with a limp wave.
"That's very helpful," Mrs. Winship muttered. "Narrows it down to about 2 million acres.
She stood up, smoothed her slacks, and slung her purse over one shoulder.
"Next time you see your son, please inform him that his grandmother strongly suggests that he turn himself in to the police as soon as possible. Tell him that's the only way I can help him out of this mess."
"I will, Millie. But DJ listens to me about as good as Whitney listens to you." Mrs. Winship let the remark slide. Duane Sr. had a right to be bitter. He loved Whitney, but she'd left him anyway. "According to the newspapers, Duane's book bag was found at the scene of the arson," Mrs. Winship said. "How could that possibly be true if he's innocent?" Duane Sr. spilled out his jumbled theory about the government tax collector stealing Junior's backpack from the house. Mrs. Winship looked doubtful.
"Well, we've certainly got our work cut out for